You're listening to Red Center, your roundup of Red Camera news from the crew at fxguide.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Red Center. I'm Mike Seymour.
Hi.
And how are you, Jason?
I'm well, thanks, Mike.
So we've been away. Well, I think so. Away is the right way to put it. We've actually been working. I've certainly been hard at work. And I should point out, Jason, that I was looking at the stats because somebody complained we hadn't got out a podcast in the last week or so, which is true. But we've tried to do them every fortnight, and we're actually batting above our average. One every 2 weeks over the almost year we've been going now.
It was going to be every couple of weeks, and I think we ended up actually being almost doing it weekly there for a while. But life has, work's got in the way, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that we have to juggle stuff with work is because we are both working professionals, and in my case, certainly I wasn't even in the country, but you've been busy on your own shoots.
Yes, I've been doing three-letter chicken-based fast food products based in the southern states of the United States.
Oh, excellent. I used to do a lot of those, actually, back in the day.
And you've been doing a upcoming TV series.
I have, in the UK, which we will talk about in April in depth. But I will say I've been having an absolute ball, Jace. I mean, we stuck every conceivable kind of lens in front of those red cameras. We had multiple red cameras, terrific workflow. Shout out to people like Dean who were on it. We're going to talk to a bunch of people from that and discuss the workflow, multi-camera shoots, syncing, all the stuff that you want to in April, and we're allowed to talk about it when we come out from under our NDA.
But a pretty problem-free shoot so far, by the sound of it.
Yeah, there was it was an exceptionally good shoot. I guess there are two big things for me. Well, there's three things, I guess, sitting here today. One is there's a bunch of news that we're going to have to get to, and we're looking forward to doing that. Secondly, as I say myself, I've been shooting hardcore weeks at a time in the UK on Reds and really pushing them fairly hard and having a ball. We had a couple of minor problems, but nothing. And the footage just looks magnificent, but tons of green screen, tons of effects. And the third thing I wanted to flag, which I think is really exciting, is I got to see The Knowing, the film shot with the Red camera in Melbourne, Nicolas Cage, and so we'll talk about that upcoming. But what about you, Jace? What's on your agenda?
Right. Well, I guess a bit of news, red-wise. Some bad news, and then it sort of really got really good, actually. Basically, I think the first bit of news, which kind of just made me think, oh, look, just forget it. Let's sort of scrap this whole red podcast thing and move on, was basically they said, they announced that obviously with the economic crisis, that they would basically scale down production a little bit, slow down a bit, which doesn't sound great, but then when you actually think about it from Red's point of view, scaling down from their point of view means going from absolute mad scramble, overtime panic, back to like normal hours that any other company does. So they have decided that they're going to go back to a more normal production schedule, and that will probably add a couple of months to all the release dates of all the upcoming stuff, which kind of was a bit of a...
I guess I'm of a slightly different point of view. I mean, I'm just really worried about burnout from the guys.
Yeah,
You got a really good team. If you burn them out, they're not going to be around. People drift off and just say, look, it was fun, but it's too intense.
Yeah.
So,
I think obviously they were sort of worried that they were going to pumping tons of money into overtime, into cameras that, in their eyes, people weren't necessarily rushing to buy. I disagree. I think, I think they're almost bulletproof, I think. I mean, there may be worse to come, but I think they're probably, they're going to sell a crap load of cameras regardless.
I guess while you were feeling that, I was actually going the other way, because having sort of spent a lot of time hardcore shooting vast amounts of material and having seen The Knowing projected as 35mm, I was the exact opposite. I was busting to get back to the podcast because, if anything, it sort of reaffirmed my total belief that the digital cinematography wave we're in is going to, what did you do, Daddy, when digital cinematography was coming? That's so cool. I really, amazing advance. And not just, Red is obviously the primary focus. We obviously cover a bunch of other things.
Sure.
And I think there's just been some awesome stuff happening. So,
since we last spoke, there's been Oscars. And Oscars awarded to Slumdog Millionaire, shot on a vast proportion of it, shot digitally. And Benjamin Button, shot 100% digitally.
Did you like Slumdog?
I have not seen Slumdog.
Slumdog Millionaire. Slumdog Actually, Millionaire. It's really
I haven't
good.
Seen it yet.
No,
really,
it is.
I really
it's
got
exceptionally
it's definitely
good.
On the list, particularly like on the it. List since BAFTA Awards and numerous Oscars. I'm definitely, yes, I have,
dig
to,
it the
I have
most.
To do it. Okay. But then what sort of took me out of my mild red-based depression was one...
Feeling blue? Sorry. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Go on.
Is one little shot of a guy holding a... looks surprisingly like Stu Mashwitz holding
Stu shot?
Holding a little DSMC with a red little 7-inch red monitor on it, and it's just probably the smallest package you can get to actually shoot handheld with. But basically, the main thing was it's alive. It's come out of renders, and there's actually something physical to see. There's a couple of shots on Red User of the DSMC just being handheld, and another one. A fully sort of built rig with battery packs and in-out modules and things all stacked up on a shoulder. So it was sort of really nice at the end of all of that to see something physical, to see an actual prototype in the hand being, and it sort of suddenly all made it very, very real. And I thought, oh, hurry up, I want it. It just looks awesome. And I really think just looking at that one shot that really is, I think it's definitely going to change the way I shoot.
Well, I've got an idea for you. I think in April, we should devote April to being workflow month, because we were going to discuss all the stuff of Scarlett coming out. But my suggestion to you now, I've sprung this on you, I know.
Yes.
Is when we get to our April Red Centers, we actually do a kind of series that covers hardcore workflow, because by then, two things will happen. Firstly, we'll have whoever's going to announce new products at NAB, so we'll be able to cover those.
Yep.
And secondly, I think we're just about due for... Because you and I were discussing before, the reason we started Red Center was to cut through the crap, basically, right, and give a clear picture. And I think it's about time we did a sort of survey and summary of all the options. And, of course, I'll be able to talk about the big project we've done, and we'll be able to just give a good summary of, like, not only the news, but actually the opinions as to how you should go about doing stuff and dealing with things. What do you reckon?
Yep, good call. That sounds good because, yep, I think that there's... I mean, also in light of the last podcast, workflow still was, at least for me, was a bit of a pain. We'll touch on that later. But, yeah, look, there's still plenty of traps around, you know, two years out.
All right. Well, let's make it April is workflow month, and we'll do a workflow on how the current state of the art, the best way about doing things, and hopefully we'll get that done in April. If it doesn't, it will spill into May. I don't care.
Well, it may be bigger than one episode, I'd say.
Oh, definitely more than one episode, yeah.
Yep.
Hey, so what other news do you have? Because I have lots of kind of funky news.
Okay. Red have announced, well, it's shown prototypes or final sort of production shots of their Red Primes. They're estimated to come out early to mid-09, so coming soon. 100mm, 85, 50, 35, and 25. We knew these were all coming, but
how
it's just...
How fast are they?
Well, they were originally going to be 1.8s, 1.9s, actually. They're all going to be 1.9s, and I think one of the other announcements, but they're basically, once they finished with the production, they sort of worked out that they're now all just that little tiny 15th bit faster, and they're all 1.8 lenses, which is great. The faster, the better. I've no idea what these things are going to cost, but they are slowly going to start rolling them out in the next month or two, which would be great if you're afford.
Even on my stills camera, I've moved to prime lenses. I was shooting in London a lot, and I was shooting basically almost everything was either a 50 or a 20, and I had two really fast and really nice Canon 50 and 20 lenses, and I realized that it was like a my cinema filming life folding into my private life, in that I would just go on off Zoom so much. You know, I walk a step or two forward or a step or two backwards to do a manual Zoom.
Exactly. And you can sort of see just how nice, you know, you think you sort of got this thing about 50 mil, like just the humble 50 mil, that 50 mil is dull, or it's a boring size. It's not telephoto. It's not wide. What is it? It's nothing. It's vanilla.
It's portrait.
But you know, on what you're probably shooting on your 5D, which is like full frame 35 with
shallow
depth of field on a 1.4 or 1.8, whenever it was. Awesome, gorgeous results, and really small, really light lens. And as you say, you know, rather than have a zoom, walk back, walk forward a step, walk back a step.
And I did a whole kind of behind the scenes essay on this project, and I was showing it to the director, and he was just like, "Wow, I've never seen this handled this way." Like, obviously, other people have done it with other films, but for him, he'd never had one of his projects documented this way.
Yeah, yeah,
and it's just delightful. So we'll be able to publish some of those in April. Can I get to my news, or you've got more stuff to go? I'm busting. Yeah. Weeks of cool stuff.
Well, there was a couple of screenshots. I'm not quite sure why the doggy kind of pixie photo kind of shots keep going with Red, but they've got to think about dogs. But there was also, apart from seeing Crud,
a bulldog, I could get it, right? That was kind of tough. That was gym. But this is like...
I'm sure, now, this could be, this is someone at Red's dog, so don't, you know, I'm a cat person myself. But
I'm a dog guy, but that just looks like, I don't know, Paris Hilton was visiting Red. Is one of the Red guys dating her? Maybe that's the reason.
But anyway. Obviously, not only have they just got some prototype, you know, boxes to throw around and put on shoulders, they've actually, you know, these things are actually functioning. So there's some frame grabs from a 2/3 inch Scarlett with a little prototype 25mm mini Red Prime, so shot at 3K. So there's some nice little tidbits being thrown out there to sort of make us to realise that they're still going.
Cool. Well, if you finish with Red per se, I'm going to jump into non-Red news. And the big one, I guess, that caught a lot of attention for people is that Avid announced that Avid DS was going to be able to read native R3D files. Now, Avid DS is what was Digital Studio. It was bought as part of the acquisition of Softimage back in the day before they... obviously, they've divested of it recently, but ages ago when they bought it, this was basically a flame. And it's always stuck on the side of the product line because it's basically an online box. And it runs off a sort of completely different mindset, if you like, to an Avid, as you would describe. You say Avid to somebody, it's almost an adjective or an Avid for offline editing, right? Like, it's just, you know,
yes,
what it stands for. But
because this wasn't the announcement I was hoping for.
No, you want to just reading normally. But the thing about it is that, and... Let me run through a few things on it. Firstly, the DS works with it because of Metafuse. Now, Metafuse is free. You can get it at avid.com/metafuse, but with a Z, M-E-T-A-F-U-Z-E. And it's free download, or it'll come standard from now on. And Metafuse doesn't just handle Red R3D files. It handles, say, a TIFF sequence, or you could throw a whole bunch of frames at it. And it does sensible things like auto scene detect as it's running through on stuff. It runs on Windows XP 32 or 64, and also to get around the problem of Linux, it actually runs in a version of an operating system called Wine. Now, Jace, Wine 1.0 is effectively, it is to Windows what and Linux what Parallels is to OS X.
To run Mac on Windows.
Yeah, so this thing allows you to run up basically stuff that's not designed for Linux in a Linux environment, simulating effectively a Windows environment.
Right.
That makes sense. And one of the reasons for that, if you think about it, is that QuickTime itself is inherently a Mac format, obviously, or an Apple format, but it built out to Windows. But what it's not built out to very well is Linux. And if you think about R3D files, they're very much intertwined with QuickTimes and the whole idea of QuickTimes and the idea of having a file that references back to a master file, all that kind of stuff. And that's just not very well supported in Linux. There's not a lot of codecs. There's not a lot of Linux support for QuickTimes full stop. And so that's been one of the big struggles with people that are running on Linux operating systems, being able to access the Linux SDK and come up with a really good solution for native adoption, which is why you've seen native adoption in some products much, much earlier than others. For example, Autodesk, you know, if they were running on Windows, they'd have had an R3D implementation, I reckon, out way in advance. Though, obviously, watch this space for NAB, because I think that'll be one of the announcements that... We're hoping to see
Windows, but there's Windows Avid Media Composers.
Now, the problem there is slightly different, right? Because the problem there is that Avid basically built their philosophy around DNX HD. And so DNX HD is their kind of standard thing in the way that Final Cut's built around a QuickTime.
Yeah.
And so what they basically want is to keep everything running in their DNX HD. Now, to do that, you have to basically transcode from the file format of choice, in this case an R3D, say QuickTime, over to a DNX HD. And DNX HD has therefore no longer got any Red properties per se. And that's where things like automatic dark and a whole lot of the workflow stuff has come in. But interestingly, I have news there as well, because Baseline has set up a transfer machine, which I don't know if they've nicknamed it, but we've got something calling it the BLT around the office, Base Light Transfer Station. And this BLT is kind of about €30,000. So it's pretty much in the scratch territory.
Yeah.
And it's designed so that you can load up R3D files and in not real time, but sort of near real time, run those to DNX HD. Now, this is kind of significant because DNX HD is not free. If you are an equipment supplier that wants to, you know, output DNX HD, you actually have to pay a license fee to Avid, which is one of the reasons why Scratch or Assimilate that makes Scratch has been resistant. They've actually had it in their publicity or their press kits for a while that they were going to go to DNX HD as a natural output format. So Scratch would read a R3D. But before they've had a chance to implement it or before they've agreed on a price with Avid, the BLT has come out, the Base Light Transfer Machine, and that's actually doing exactly that. So I would load up my R3Ds, and it would output DNX HD. It would not do them in real time, but it will do them in near real time, and then that will allow me to take that into my Avid. Now,
so this is 30,000, 20,000, whatever euros to file convert from R3D to be able to be used in an Avid.
Have Avid got a history, in your opinion, of being an open architecture kind of company?
I don't know. I've no idea.
No, not really.
Well, I've no idea. All I know is my.
They don't play well with others.
Yeah, I like to, occasionally suggest Red, and every time I do, somebody kicks me in the nuts.
No, I understand, and your nuts are hurting, I'm sure, but I'm trying to get you there. I'm trying. I swear to God, with technology to get you across the line. One of the great things about MetaFuse, and also for that matter, what's happening with the Baselight machine, is that it isn't losing the metadata as it comes in. So one of the problems you've got is if you transcode the material from QuickTime to DNX HD, you tend to lose the metadata. And by going both of those separate routes, you in fact won't lose the metadata. And when we're talking about cool performance stuff, two other things that are kind of related that I wouldn't normally talk about, but they're kind of fun. I wouldn't normally talk about it because they're kind of dull, and that's hard drives. The first one is, I guess it's interesting to note that the GTEC guys are now shipping a solid-state drive, which is interesting, isn't it? Around the same time that Red is shipping their solid-state drive.
It's almost as if there was some connection. Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, and then the other thing I want to talk about is Global Store. Now,
hang on. Is the red one, is that a rated? That's a rated solid state?
We don't really need to be rated when it's solid state.
Okay, so when we're solid state, we're saying it's absolutely rock solid. Nothing's going to go wrong with it. There's no need for a raid.
Yeah, sort of, pretty much. Okay. I mean, it's not. I mean, is a CF car rated? Not really. No, but
no,
it's pretty
true,
rock solid.
True. Yeah, true.
Certainly not prone to, heads crashing onto platters and stuff.
True.
Okay, the other thing I talked about is Global Store. Now, Global Store is makers of servers and stuff. And what's really interesting about that is obviously your laptop and mine, I think, or certainly our Macs and stuff, we're all used to, quad cores and stuff. What I want to talk about is the performance that they're getting out of playback from the Global Stores, because initially you needed a four core or rather a multi-proc system overclocked, really ranked up to the max to get basically half res or 2K playback in high quality.
Back up to what Global Store is.
It's a disk thing.
Okay.
Did I not say that?
No, I don't know.
I skipped that bit. Director eyes glassing over. Okay, let me put it in creative terms for you. No, you're technical, but I'm going to give it to you in creative terms. Because if you are finding my enthusiasm for this product somewhat less than thrilling, then so will everyone else apart from,
share your enthusiasm.
Two other people that are listening. Hello, Stu and Dean. So, okay, so basically you want to have a big box sitting there so that you can play your R3Ds back in real time at 2K. Full stop. You want to be able to decode the R3Ds, not having to transcode them, just decode them on the fly, nice high quality, and just watch it playing back 2K, not from a proxy, but actually from the R3Ds.
Right.
If you can do that, you're at a really significant goalpost. 2K real-time playback, thanks for playing. We love that. That also means you can go out to, say, a tape deck and go to an SR deck in real time. Lots of reasons why it's fun to watch 2K in real time at high quality.
Gotcha.
Now, what they've done by going to the new i7 CPUs, and just bear with me because this will ungeek out in a second, is that they can get one CPU, not two, to do this performance that we want, which is 2K basically real-time high quality. Now, you might say, so I'm still in the land of Nod as to why I'm enthusiastic about that. But if you, in fact, are looking at Red Stereo, then now all of a sudden you could have dual CPUs decoding two streams of R3D in real time at 2K high quality. And that, my friend, is kind of sexy. Now, have they announced that? No, they have not announced that. But my prediction is that that is coming, and I have it on reliable sources that watch this space at NAB. And so once you start getting dual 2K streams in real time decoded from the R3Ds, you're getting some really serious performance. And that'll become particularly significant when they release the new boxes or the new cameras, because we're going to need that kind of performance. And in fact, we need the hard drive stuff, to stay in advance of what the RED camera can do, because as the RED code stuff goes up in quality level, so does the data rate, so does the... And this will mean, basically, that if you had one of these suckers and then you got an Epic, you'd be able to play the sucker back and not just sit there going, well, this is great, but...
Fantastic, but how am I actually going to...
But I can't watch the bugger. Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about from the original R3Ds now, not from...
Proxies
and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So that's all my kind of news and stuff, though there's much more stuff to talk about, but that'll do for now.
Awesome.
So during the week, can we change in gear? I got to see The Knowing.
Yeah, how was it? I couldn't make it. I will definitely catch up. It's coming out pretty shortly.
Yes. If you actually are in Sydney and you're a member of the VES, there's going to be a VES screening. This is a film shot on build 15 of the RED camera in Melbourne. Now, I had a tiny, tiny, tiny role in this film, so I should fess up now, in that I'm very proud of the fact that when Animal was pitching it to Alex Preuss, I happened to be the guy they pulled in, because I'm the only people that had a RED camera at that time, and showed Alex that RED for the first time. And one of the things that was really interesting is that he was quite interested to get it on his shoulder and actually feel the weight of it and do stuff. I've since learned that he never once actually filmed anything himself, though he obviously more than capable of it. But at least he knew he was into his film that if he wanted to pick up a camera and put it on his shoulders, he could. So the film is a full-on what you'd call Hollywood film. It's not set in Australia. It's in no way looks earnest like an Australian film. And that in and of itself is a bit of an accomplishment, because a lot of it's set in the fall in America. And as you know, we don't have... fall colors here like they do in the States. So,
yeah, I think they had to go over and do a whole fall section over in the States.
And a truckload of grading. And that's important, because they were literally able to grade a whole lot of these leaves and stuff to give it the fall look.
Right, to catch the green leaves and spin them to brown.
To those lovely reds and yellow tones.
Right. So
the film is shot build 15. It's shot primarily 4K, and then it's 2K out to film. Park Road Post did the film out process, and Park Road Post, as you know, have an incredibly clean pipeline, and assured me when I, you know, harassed them at a conference publicly that they had no proprietary stuff, but they just have a really clean, neat pipeline for doing stuff. And then Animalogic did the majority of the visual effects, though Booth in France did some amazing stuff at the end, which I can't tell you about because I don't want to spoil it.
Exactly, don't.
Just so you know, there'll be no spoilers. This is not a review of the film as a film. VFX, this is a technical discussion.
No.
So Booth did some amazing stuff. And then there was somebody else, one other house that did some outside windows of car type sort of shots. But Animal really gets the, you know, crown for the major visual effects work. But as we're not discussing visual effects, I'll put that to one side as well, other than to congratulate the guys, including Andrew Jackson, who I think did an outstanding job as one of the two VFX supervisors. And
yes, and Simon Duggan, DP.
Yep. And so...
Richard Leroy, editor.
And Richard Leroy, incredibly good editor. And of course, it is really a well-made film in every respect.
And at that time, you say Build 15, I mean, this is, you know, they were breaking some, you know, at the bloody bleeding edge trying to put this thing together. So, you know, even shooting anyone, I mean, Build 15 is almost like, you know, ancient history now, but people who shot a lot on it would sort of, you know, appreciate the fact that if you've done a feature film on it and got through to the other side and made it look fantastic, it's all, you know, all the more impressive.
Oh, no, totally. I mean, I remember we had a meeting with Richard, actually, where we were just giving them advice on workflow, and we got a whiteboard out, and I just started drawing on this whiteboard trying to explain to, you know, all and sundry the kind of theory of workflow, because at that stage it really was just almost black art. And I enjoyed having that. We spent like a morning working through it, and after that I wasn't involved, of course, but it was great to see it up on the screen, because at the end of the day I'd seen a few things that it was shot on RED that were in a film. but not a film that was entirely shot on Red.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I thought it looked really good.
Fantastic.
There was one scene that I thought was maybe showing some limitations of the Red camera at the schoolyard. I've since found out from talking to people in Melbourne that, in fact, that was a grading thing. It was not a camera limitation. You know, it was done that way. But this is Build 15, and it was pretty much a 6.85 pipeline from the camera, so it wasn't even the 9.85 log fight pipeline that we use with the double or other two exposure point drop to get back into kind of Cineon path. So this is theoretically as bad as you could get if you did things as well as you could when it came out. Does that make sense? Like, this is well done for where they were at,
yes.
Though we should never see anything that has to have these limitations again. The limitations they were under with 6.85, with Build 15, all of those things, you know, has moved on since then. No other film should have to face those challenges. And yet, it still looks really, really good. I mean, the blacks are terrific. There's no noise in the blacks. It's clean. It's filmic. Obviously, it lacks a little bit of sort of film grainy, floaty kind of feel, which I personally don't miss at all. There was a couple of close-ups that I thought, that looks like Red, but I think it looks like Red because I know Red so well. I know the bokeh and the way that it looks almost yeah. just so well now that I could pick it. But it wasn't like a smear, like a video thing where you kind of go... it doesn't yeah. look filmic. It
yeah,
just
yeah.
has the characteristic of what
yeah, I know what you mean.
I kind of know in the Red.
Mm.
But yeah, I thought it was terrific. I thought the soundtrack's actually quite, you know, it's quite a, as a film, I will say this, if you liked Dark City,
yep.
you'll like this.
Okay.
This is great work from everyone involved. And also I'll actually say that I'm not a huge fan of Nicolas Cage. Best film I've seen him in years. No, really.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, if you're turned off by Nicolas Cage, and some people are, don't be, because it's definitely not a sort of typical performance from him. I think it's really, really good. I think it'll
Fantastic.
Change a lot of people's opinions of stuff. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's one of those classic cases. You can discuss this stuff as much as you like, but sooner or later you've got to actually sort yeah. of stack it up.
And well, it's another good thing to be able to say. You know, people say, oh, Red, you know, I don't know, can you show me something? And you can say, well, have you seen The Knowing? It's, you know.
I would say that if I was comparing it to Get Smart, shot by a terrific cinematographer, I would say that Knowing looked much better, technically looked much better than... And I think part of that is that I don't think at any point did they go to 360-degree shutter and do some of the things that they did on Get Smart. Now, Get Smart's not a cinematic masterpiece
You're
or anything.
You're not going to let them get away with that one, are you?
Well, I think it really made it look non-filmic.
Yeah.
I understand that they may want to do that. I will point out that I wouldn't let them go to a 360-degree shutter on the project I was just on, and I'm just insisted on yeah. pumping more light into the scene.
Which is tricky because it probably was even easier back then, Build 15, to get into that trap of, you know, having an overly long shutter and, you know, be stitched up in that way. So it's pretty impressive that there's not really any sort of real giveaway shots.
No, and some of the footage in the film was shot on higher speeds, so they went down to 3K and 2K.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, like I think, you know, I'm really going to be keen to see what you think when you see it.
Yep.
Comes out in what, I think about the 20th, so in about 10 days.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the, and you said there's a special screening, just touch on that again.
Yeah, there's a special screening if you just happen to be in Sydney. And if you happen to be a member of the Sydney VES, which is actually a new branch of the VES that's been set up pretty recently. And there's an Australian screening that we have been, I'm a member of the VS as well, though I haven't been involved in actually doing any of the actual work, but that's coming up on the 13th of, in about 3 days' time.
Oh, okay. Right.
I think that's the 13th. Let me just check that.
By the time you hear this, it's too late.
I beg your pardon. The RSVP's on the 13th. The screening's on the 23rd.
Okay.
At 6:30. But you'd need to be in the VS to take part of that. Okay, so, yeah, so that's... Excellent. Pretty significant for me, and I enjoyed that tremendously. Excellent. So we wanted to answer some of your question, Jace, about the last week, if you remember, last time.
Where did I go wrong?
Well, okay. So a couple of points. Firstly,
where do we start?
In fairness to Jason, he didn't go wrong. some of the stuff that he saw is the sort of known fact that the footage looks currently different, or can look different, when you've got up setting settings that are different between the camera and stuff in post. The only thing you did wrong that I'm aware of is that when you were doing the trick of taking the QuickTime proxies into Final Cut.
Yes.
And let me just explain this to people that don't know. If you wanted to edit an R3D file in Final Cut, just edit it, finish that job, put it to bed and output it from Final Cut and say, game over. There is a trick that we've discussed here, and obviously I didn't, when I told you guys about it.
A lot of people do.
A lot of people do it, but I obviously didn't explain it well enough because clearly you didn't understand. My fault, my bad. If I've got an R3D file, so let's say I've got a shot of anything you like, the R3D file is going to have some QuickTimes in the same folder as it. And so that R3D file is, of course, as we all know, the actual RED footage. The QuickTime wrappers are just, you know, wrappers into that footage. Now, the trick is you take the wrappers into Final Cut and you edit away happily with them. If you want to get something that you're not seeing that you can't get out of Final Cut, you can go into, say, RED Alert, tweak it to get what you want, and then regenerate the QuickTimes in RED Alert. And then that would update automatically through to your Final Cut, and there you go. Now, the step that I obviously...
Which I was trying to do.
The step I skipped over, maybe I wasn't made clear enough, is when you make those QuickTimes, if the originals are still sitting in the same folder, it says, it being RED Alert, oh, I'm not going to clobber those files. I'll make a new QuickTime, -1, -2, -3, whatever. And so it'll actually make more QuickTime proxies, but the Final Cut still looks at the original proxies. You have to literally either delete or put the original proxy, the little, you know, QuickTime wrappers, in their own little folder, mark it as original or something, or don't look in here, please, Final Cut Pro.
Right.
And then when you regenerate the proxies or the QuickTimes from RED Alert, it'll regenerate those little QuickTimes, but they'll be in the same folder and the same place. And not only that, but because RED Alert looks in there and doesn't see any in there, it gives them the same name that they had before, and therefore Final Cut, when it relaunches, will see them and automatically update without having to do anything.
Now, that was a couple of weeks ago, and I'm pretty sure what I was doing was, I'm pretty sure I dragged the appropriate size proxy into Final Cut Pro, into the timeline. And when I was trying to tweak it in Red Alert, I'd hit... render quick times or whatever, or what's the command there?
Make quick times?
Yeah, exactly. And I could see in the folder all of the quick times, ding, 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 you can see them refresh, okay? Yet, in my, what I was expecting, and what I sure seemed to happen in the past, I don't know, I seem to remember something in the past where you'd change something in Red Alert and it would change immediately, maybe something's changed along the way. But I could see all the quick times refreshing in the folder. Yet I was expecting something to happen in my timeline. So you're saying that if I've got a quick time, if I've got a proxy in my timeline, it's all trimmed and I've got a nice in point, nice out point. If I want to change the look of it in Red Alert, I need to basically drag the quick time, drag the proxy back into the timeline again, trim it up and...
No, you don't need to do that. You just need to, in your filing system, in the folder that has... So let's say you've got a R3D file. The folder is called B38_COO1_3, blah, blah, blah. Inside that folder, the original folder, you need to not have the QuickTimes visible at the same level that the R3D is at.
Okay.
If that's the case, it regenerates them with the same name.
Yes.
Final Cut immediately goes, lost media, oops, I found it again, there it is, and just relinks it back in.
Okay.
And if it doesn't do that, restarting Final Cut would make it find it.
Okay.
Because it then finds the media again.
Right.
But
So the main issue, obviously, and originally, was the distinct lack of saturation in the greens and yellows, yet what looked like reasonably good skin tones. So, and you know, you've seen the file. The greens were almost grey. There wasn't a lot of colour there. Where did I go wrong? And
to do that workflow, for a start, you haven't gone completely wrong, because there just is an issue where they don't look the same. Like, we have the same problem when we're shooting in red space. When we do Angie for FX Guide TV.
Yep.
If you'd been shooting in Rec 709, Rec 709, and Rec 709, it should have been much, much closer because you're obviously working in video. But in doing that Red Space thing, we get a similar thing, and then we do a pre-grade of it to get it back. And that is something that's pretty much happened in the last two releases since about build, either build 16 or build 17. That's been the case in out of Red Alert. And so,
yeah, but even when you were changing, just watching you do it before in Red Alert, changing Red Space over to 709 in the LUT and the other thing.
Well, see, here's the thing.
It didn't sort of magically. Yeah. It never once looked like it did on set. It never looked like it did on set.
Red Alert is, I mean, for a start, I don't use Red Alert for doing that. Like, I use Red Alert for tech checking stuff, right? In reality, in the camera, there is only one place to set either Rec 709 or Red Space. There's not two things. There's not an output LUT and there's not a color space. Secondly, we just take it into, say, Scratch, which, again, only has one place to put on that LUT. And so what we get is our whole pipeline's built around that Scratch workflow. So it's not common for me to do that. If I was doing that, then I would, as I say, like we did Angie, we'd have to do a pre-grade to get it back to what I considered to be matching. But I don't have that problem because I don't do the Red Alert file pathway anymore. I do Scratch and have for now, I don't know.
Sure.
Forever.
So the fix to make it look more like... To do it the way I did it and make in Final Cut look the way it did on set is to be shooting with 709, not Red Space.
Well, that would have got it closer. But I agree, it should look the same, right? Like it should on the monitor look the same. Yeah. And it's annoying that it doesn't.
It just doesn't.
Yeah.
So
you
is
didn't
there
do anything wrong in that respect.
Okay. So is there a backstory as to why?
No, but I'll find out.
Okay.
I literally, just for you guys listening, I literally just saw this file, even though we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I've been overseas, so I only just saw it just before we went to air.
Sure.
So I haven't had a chance to really dig deep.
I'm just trying to think, because numerous people have asked me, you know, what's the fix? You know, what's the fix? What's Mike's answer?
What's Mike's answer? Mike doesn't work for Red. Mike doesn't have an answer, but Mike will work on it, and Mike will find out and get back to you.
Yeah, because I guess I'm just trying to, for next time... next time I tell you, I won't be doing it that way. I'll be doing it. The other issue was that I shot 16:9, which I think seriously hampers the other work, the white paper Final Cut Pro Red white paper workflow of being able to go through. Do it another way.
Through log and transfer?
Through log and transfer.
Well, now, that was true, but remember I told you not to use it while ago.
Okay, all right, sorry.
I said, don't use this on anything but, you know, 4K.
So I'm still okay to shoot 16:9 because I still want to, and I still want to use all the neg in inverted commas.
I have no problem shooting 16:9. I shoot 16:9.
Yeah. You shot 16:9 for your other thing?
In UK? Yeah, we shot tons of 16:9.
Okay.
But, you know, there are some issues. It's even an issue on the camera. Like on the camera, if you try and do playback when you're jam syncing with audio going into the camera, sometimes you'll get it looks like, we jokingly call it green screen of death. It actually isn't crashed and it isn't corrupt. It just won't play back the clip from the camera.
Yeah.
And it's just full green. And you go, what the frig? And then you check it and it's fine.
Yeah, yeah. But on the day, while you're there playing it back, doing essentially the gate check,
you know, freak.
You're thinking, oh my God.
Confidence check.
Yeah.
Not confident.
Not at all confident.
That's a bug, and I certainly emailed ages to the Red guys about that.
Sure, sure. Okay. So is there... Well, I guess the other sort of workaround fix would be to work out how do I make it so that what I'm seeing on set looks like
what you're getting in post.
What I'm going to see when I drop something into the timeline.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to research that, and for our upcoming April workflow, I'm going to have definitive answers for you. Cool. How about that?
Yes. I mean, obviously, our fix, final fix, at the end of the day, they needed to change a couple of other things in that job anyway. So we did end up going into a full grading station anyway and spitting out 2K TIFF sequences and going to do a full grade, basically. So we sort of got around that. But if I wasn't going that way, it was looking like quite a painful secondary colour grade to take those yellows and lift them and take the greens and lift them and slowly, bit by bit, recreate what was there by eye.
Yep.
Anyway.
You're right. That was annoying.
Okay. We will
research it and get back to you with a more definitive workflow kind of thing, hopefully. Sorry to not have that. I mean, honestly, don't work that way because, you know, we just shoot so much red. We hammer it through.
Through scratch.
Of course. And we do duck and stuff to Avid and we do all sorts of stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
If you guys have questions and stuff you'd like us to research for the April workflow kind of month of discussion on that, please just email us at red@fxguide.com and we'll add it to the list. We're not going to try and cover every obscure kind of workflow, but we're definitely going to try and give you the, you know, current state of the art. And also not just what the options are, but what we kind of recommend is a good way to go forward. Because, you know, there are things that we used to do a year ago that we don't do anymore. And I realized in talking about this that we haven't ever sort of gone back and said, nobody does that anymore.
Yes.
So to clean the slate, as it were, we'll give a clean makeover in April.
Awesome. Because, yeah, I mean, it still is a bit of an issue. But also, I mean, there is still people who are a bit of a stick in mud about digital in general. Before we started shooting this last batch of commercials I did, because the schedule and the budget and everything was looking tight, I suggested, well, look, you know, let's we're going to be doing 35. Instead of doing 35, let's shoot red, and then that'll buy us that extra half a day, or it'll buy us that second camera body and let us, you know, get what we need to get done. And this is a client who has a long-standing no digital policy. Obviously, you know, been burnt in the past. So we basically pitched it and put a whole bunch of a DVD together of 10 red clips and trailers and things and 10 things on film and asked the client, can you pick the film? Can you pick the digital? And which they could not. And they basically said, no, you're right. We can't pick. And we still don't want to go digital.
I guess for me, the thing is that the thing that pushes it over the edge is like, even if you just get completely like, I don't care about the thing and the digital and I don't care and the money and the thing and I don't care about any of that.
No.
It's having a 4K frame and then going, you know what, these two shots are too similar. Can we like punch in a bit on this one and then it's giving us a whole new option.
Can we make a close-up out of a wide or
yeah.
a close-up
not,
out
not,
of a mid?
Not obviously a super close-up, no, but sure. Definitely... I mean, definitely able to just stop two shots that look a bit similar.
Stop being a jump, yeah.
And just sort of get something that flows better in the cut. And I mean, that option is pretty enormous. I mean, you're not going to get that out of anything else like a Genesis or anything.
Absolutely. Every time I've pitched it, that's always been one of the pluses, is that particularly, as I've said before, when you're shooting kids or whatever, or situations where you really sometimes do get one shot at it and you don't have the time, or you can't necessarily, for continuity reasons, recreate that shot exactly twice in a wide and a tight, and you don't have the money for two cameras. Essentially, it's sort of poor man's two cam sort of setup, really. But, you know, it can definitely save your bum.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, you know, obviously you wouldn't, in a cut from the same shot wide and on the close-up on the same line. But if you were trying to cut back and you felt like, I'm keep cutting back to the same darn shot,
sometimes
reframing is gorgeous. And, you know, it's more than that even. It's just like little things, you know. Just you get stuff back and you're looking at it and you're going, you know what, my eye is kind of distracted by this thing over here. Let's just reframe that a bit. That performance, she moved off a mark a bit and it was great performance. And can we just, you know, adjust for that?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that reframing is just... really underestimated. And quite frankly, the number of times in the old days people used to say to me, how much can I blow up?
Yeah, and you'd say, and, well
10-20%, yeah,
exactly.
Whatever.
Not much.
But I was asked that question a lot because people were desperate to do it. And I don't think it's people just being slack filmmakers. I just think that, I think on set, directing, I say this because when I was in London, I actually got promoted from VFX supervisor to second unit director, which you'll laugh at, right? Me directing, right? Okay, but... anyway,
snigger,
yes, I know. But I was second unit directing, and it's hard friggin' work. It's hard, really hard to be empathetic to the actors and to, you know, to get stuff across. And
yeah, that balance of getting it done, but also getting it done right and satisfying the creative and the technical.
Yeah, because like suddenly I had a shot and I was like, well, you go off and shoot that whole sequence. And it was second unit. I was like, okay. And so like the first thing I asked was, well, what is your point for this in the, what's the point of this scene in the story? Like what's the subtext? What are we trying to get out of it?
Mm.
You know, what is the kind of response that we're expecting? Am I expecting to be with this character, against this character? Am I meant to be impressed or is it meant to be humorous? And, you know, where is it coming from? And once I got that, I started thinking how I could express that. And then also some visual shorthand for communicating the attributes that the director had wanted this character to exhibit. So I was like, how can I, because there was no dialogue for this scene. It was all done in like a montage. And I'm like, okay, well, how can I come at that with some really funky, interesting framing and stuff? Now, all of that's going on. Hard for me to think technically. Hard for me to think, you know. Yeah. And so then I'm like all about the performance and is the actress cold and, you know, stuff to do with lighting. And then I'm like, later I'm like, well, just fix it in post. And I'm hearing myself say it to myself and I'm thinking, oh, you total git. That is exactly what you've always said. So hard to... And I'm like, actually it is. It actually is really hard.
Yeah, and it's once you've done that kind of thing, then you... Exactly, then you... Or the other way. Once if I find it easier having done some post in the background or in the past to... It makes it easier when you're on that set to sort of make that calculation. Okay, it's going to take me half an hour to fix it now. Or, you know, 15, I might can do it in 15 minutes or whoever.
But even if it's going to take longer than 15 minutes, there's, you know, like you're
it's
on a
one
location.
One person for an hour versus.
Yeah, we're on a location and there's like, you know, it's going to take me, like it did, to fix this, like a long time, like a couple of hours to fix it. But having said that, a couple of hours of me versus the entire crew at 1 o'clock in the morning when we're going to be out of that location, it's a big, But having said that, the thing, what my point about it, though, bringing that up was. I was stunned at just, you know, once you flip over from the technical role to trying to, and then it's really hard to juggle both.
That's sort of why I don't really, and I've sort of touched on this before, I don't really sort of shoot my own sort of stuff anymore because it's really, I find it really hard to strike that balance and to focus 100% on the technique, on the performance and all those things. You talk about the timing and the character and all that stuff, and also be looking at focus and exposure. So, I mean, I absolutely just, you know, bow down and kiss the feet of people like Soderbergh or whatever who can shoot and respect. Direct to, you know, the level that they do.
And Woody Allen that would act in it and direct. I mean, that's got to be impossible.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson...
acting and directing, I suppose, in a way, as long as you've got a great DP with you who in a way has to be part director as well. They have to take care of the technical stuff.
But I was
also
just parked at the goddamn split.
Yeah, so no, absolutely just in awe of people who can technically shoot something and look at some of the imagery that's Steve Soderbergh's done and also and look at the level of performances. It just astounds me that, you know, you can do it. And left brain and right brain is just, you know, I just can't do it.
No, well, I certainly have new respect for your craft, sir. I enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong, freaking ball, but yeah, yes, no,
it's
definitely,
and it's nice to be handed the responsibility, and you know, it's great. Oh, that's my bit.
Though you know what, the flip side of that is the cold terror down your back of when the first unit director comes over to see what you shot in second unit, and you're just like holding your breath, literally, that they're not going to go, "Oh, not that." What were you thinking?
No. Why did you do it that way? I had a director that I used to do an awful lot of second unit stuff for, and he's one of those people that's just really controlling that he just should not have a second unit person. There's like almost every shot really needs to be shot by him. He just could not, doesn't matter where you put the camera, it'd be in the wrong spot.
No, I was lucky I didn't have that.
No, it's just awful. And then you do every, even no matter how long you've been doing it for, you always get that dread. He comes over to look at it and you just know, here it comes. Yep, there we go. Doesn't like it. Where do we need to put the camera this time? So you're always going to be planning to do every shot three times because some people just can't delegate.
I did not have that problem. I had an incredible, I mean, I just couldn't imagine. And also the other thing is the cast and crew we were working with. I mean, we talk about this in April, but just some of the finest I've ever worked with. So anyway,
excellent.
Hey, that's it for my stuff. Do you have anything else on the agenda for this week? Because we're not going to do a Red Room and stuff because we had so much other stuff to cover.
No. Next week, hope to speak to John Ellerbrook from Gates Underwater Housings about the new red underwater housing he's got. So if you're into H2O, could be a good one.
And just on a side note, and hopefully you can stick it in the show notes, you had that cool photo of the rig from...
Yes, I'm trying to think who sent it to me, but it was awesome. It was the picture
of... It's not a red rig, it's a...
No, it's the basically the Slumdog Millionaire camera, the Mumbai slums camera side of things, which was all shot on the SI2K camera, which basically it's an ARRI side handle with an SI2K with a Zeiss Prime in it, a clip-on matte box and a monitor, and a strapped underneath it is a little gyro, essentially like the kind of gyro off you would put on bottom of a Steadicam or on a aerial mount. Basically, clearly, to be able to stabilize a really small little lightweight camera like that. It's like, if you pick up those little palm cameras now, impossible to keep. They're so lightweight, there's no momentum. Momentum to them. They really just pick up. And you see it a lot with the 5D Mark II footage too. It's every little tiny tremor in the pulse of your hands. I don't know why. It's quite a big camera, but it all transmits right through to the lens. So putting this little gyro on the bottom is quite interesting. It really sort of obviously it's like holding a spinning bike wheel. It totally locks it, and you almost have to sort of force your way around. Anyone who's played with gyroscopes, I love gyroscopes, anyone who's played with gyros and tried to move them, it's really sort of really stabilizes your shots. And
inertia is your friend.
Inertia, physics, I love it. So it's, I'll put that little picture on the show notes as well, but it's really quite interesting. And the shot of the DSMC is that those two shots, that is
one of the reasons
the future. And I'm not being a techno geek. This is because of what it lets you do. It's what it let Slumdog, how Slumdog got
shot.
Well,
we're going to want a rig like that on Scarlett's, right? I mean, that's why I'm kind of interested in it.
Yeah, exactly.
That gyro rig is exactly something that's going to need on Scarlett.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, basically, they could not have done Slumdog without a camera like that to be able to be, put a recorder in your backpack and just run through the streets.
And if anyone knows what the aerial-looking thing is coming out of the I.O. module in the released photos from Red, like, email us. Obviously, it could be a Red remote.
The transmitter for the Red remote, or maybe it's a video transmitter. I just that's another thing I didn't talk about when we talked about some of these new renders. Yes, there's a new one, a little aerial coming out of the I.O. module on the basically Scarlett or Epic, whatever you like. And I just love this lack of cabling that's coming along. If you look at the average camera with wireless transmitters and monitors and things, that's just love it.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Our cameras on set were just behemoths of
cables. Yeah, it doesn't take much, does it?
Double battery packs and HD transmitters and,
yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We really appreciate it. Thanks for Mike. The emails you've got. And thank you, Jace. I've enjoyed chatting with you again.
Thank you. Always. Yes, good to have you back. Mike, where can we find you?
Interestingly, I'm on, obviously, FX Guide, and I have a Twitter feed, which is twitter.com/MikeSeymour. But I wanted to point out Avid Technology has a Twitter feed. twitter.com/AvidTechnology if you want to follow along and get the latest updates on stuff that's going on there. And what about you, Jace?
JasonWingrove.com or just Wingrove on Twitter.
Excellent. Until next time, guys, thanks so much. See ya.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us red@fxguide.com. Copyright 2008 FX Guide, LLC.